You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. We're joined today by Rory Cormack, who's an Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Nottingham, a fellow of the Royal Historical Society and a leading expert among a new generation of intelligence historians. He specializes in British covert operations and the secret pursuit of foreign policy. He has published widely on intelligence and security issues and regularly appears on radio and television. He's a co-author of The Black Door, Spy, Secret Intelligence, and British Prime Ministers, and featured on Channel 4's Spying on the Royals. His newest book is Disrupt and Deny, Spy, Special Forces, and the Secret Pursuit of British Foreign Policy. So welcome, Rory. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Thanks for having me.
So let me ask this question. This is an expansive book. This isn't covering just one small period of British covert action. This is decades and decades of British covert action. So what made you think it was time to write a book like this?
It was supposed to be a lot smaller than it actually was. But I soon realized that the British understanding of covert action is just horribly broad, which kind of forced me to look at more than I was initially planning to or hoping to. But I thought there hasn't really been a book giving the broad history of British covert action. We think of it as an American thing, an American phrase, but I kept seeing the phrase covert action turn up in British files. And I realized there's more out there in the British files than I think people realized. So I thought, well, now's the time to write a book based almost entirely on archives, on files. And tried to go as far as I possibly could, but obviously the archival evidence starts to thin out in the 70s or 80s. But even then, there's still surprising amounts of material available.
Well, you brought my next question, a great segue here, is because we've had a lot of authors who have spent a lot of time in American archives, National Archives or others. The British classification system is different than the United States. There's, in some cases, less access to a lot of documents, in some cases, more access. How much more, because you've done some kind of over the Atlantic research into American intelligence as well. How much different is it working within the British archives versus American version?
It is so different. The Brits classify all MI6 material, all special forces material, most MI5. The only stuff that's out is wartime, pre-World War II and some World War II. And it's difficult to get hold of material. So what we have to do is try and be creative in thinking about, well, what other file might this pop up in? And some of the coolest stuff I got for the book came from Treasury files, for example, because maybe they're less stringent and less on the lookout for secret stuff. But oddly, a lot of material on Britain that you can't really get back home is available here. Because our intelligence services obviously work so closely together, things will pop up in presidential archives here, in the national archives here. And so to be able to study British intelligence, you almost have to use the National Archives at home, mm-hmm. plus private archives at home, plus presidential archives, plus the National Archives here, and have a really multi-archival approach to be able to fill in those gaps. The British archives, I would say, are a lot easier to use, much easier to use. And I always feel I've been to American archives quite a few times, but every time I go, I feel like a junior undergraduate hitting the archives for the first time.
Even if you've been there a lot, you still feel like, what the hell is it? I mean, the OSS archives, one day someone might do something to help you find things, but it's not anytime soon. I often talk about intelligence history as being incredibly frustrating to research, but it's also, it's a bit exciting if you have a certain personality, because you do get to kind of, how do I get around this problem, right? I'm not going to get the document that I need from CIA. I'm not going to get the document I need from SIS. How can I nibble around the edges and find this information? It's only like a detective story in many cases. I mean, I know for some of my research, I found something incredibly important on an anesthesiology webpage, because a guy who was very integral in World War II intelligence later became a lawyer for American Anesthesiologists Foundation. And so they had decided to publish his unpublished memoir. So like one of the random places, like did you chase certain threads and leads to places you were completely unexpecting to find something worthwhile?
It is frustrating, but I think I have that personality type that you mentioned. I love the challenge. I love the challenge of trying to tell a story of something that clearly happened that we haven't formally admitted happened, and there's crumbs, and you get to go on these journeys to try and stitch these bits and pieces together. But the thing that I found most striking in that journey was how banal a lot of the stuff that's classified and redacted actually is. So you'll come across a document and it'll all be redacted, all blacked out, and you think, okay, I want to see what's in here. The title's super cool. It's going to be intriguing. And so you squirrel around the archives trying to find, well, who else might have read it? Which other department's files might it pop up in? And I remember there was one particular file and I was desperate to get hold of it. I spent ages in the archives trying to think, well, maybe the Foreign Office's Maritime and Transport Department might have a copy. And sure enough, I managed to track it down. And it wasn't redacted in this other version. And you get that feeling, you get so super excited. Opened it up and it was the most boring thing. And I was so disappointed. So you have, yeah, it's a challenge. You have lots of frustrations. But when you do get that little bit of gold, it is very exciting.
Well, I mean, it's a target-rich environment. You have things that, by definition, haven't been seen. Right? It's not like doing history in other fields where, in many cases, you're kind of reinterpreting something mm-hmm. that people already know about. When something gets declassified, you're the first non-government official or person that didn't work directly on it to actually have seen this stuff. Especially when you're talking about covert action, which is the most secret of the secret. And maybe SIGINT might be a little step further. I mean, the GCHQ stuff and NSA stuff might be locked up for a long, long time. When you're talking about more traditional intelligence or covert action, these covert actions are covert and intended to be covert for a long, long time.
Yeah, and but there's still traces, and there's obviously no covert action file series at the National Archives. And kind of, I'm glad there isn't, because then it would be easy and everyone would be doing it. But there are enough little clues, little nibbles in different departments to be able to build a narrative from all these little fragments. So we don't have the problem. I think it's a luxury that, I don't know, a more traditional diplomatic historian might have when they would be doing, say, British or American policy towards NATO in the 1950s, 60s. They'd have so many files to look through, and I don't know where you'd start. If you're doing standard diplomatic history, pre-war diplomacy, you will have literally tens of thousands of bits of paper to look through. Whereas us, we're relying on snippets and half-redacted quotes, and then trying to build a robust narrative from that, which I find much more enjoyable. But I don't know how diplomatic historians do it. We're having this massive abundance of sources.
Well, let's look at the kind of the bottom line up front of the book and kind of the argument. And really, you mentioned that the fact that most people think of the United States when they think of covert action, but the British have been incredibly involved in doing this. This, you know, your book has plenty of sources that tell us that to be true. So let me ask a question again. This is kind of the underlying question to me of the book, is why did the British become so dependent on covert action during the post-war period? Really focus on the Cold War and beyond. I wrote a bunch of reasons down, you know, and if you don't get to some of them, I'll jump right in. But there's a lot of them. And I think that you do a good job in laying these out, and it makes a ton of sense why this happened.
Yeah, I think the main reason is because coming out of World War II, we had no money. We were skinned. We were completely bankrupt. Well, not completely, but near bankrupt. And yet we still had and have this perception of ourselves as a global power with responsibilities all over the world. And this created a massive mismatch between the capabilities we actually had, the number of armed forces, the money we had to spend, versus our perceived responsibilities. And successive prime ministers saw the hidden hand as a way to bridge that gap, as a way to mask decline, as force multiplication. And we see it even still today in an era when the UK government has cut pretty much every single organ of state, including the armed forces, the foreign office, traditional diplomacy. It's just intelligence and special forces which have seen increases. And I think Britain sees it as a force multiplier to allow us to carry on playing a global role when our actual capabilities are dwindling.
I mean, covert action kind of writ large, whether it's the British, the Americans, or anybody else, does have some added advantages to it as well. I mean, everything from, you talked about force multiplier, but also things that you couldn't necessarily do overtly, you know, whether, you know, dealing with terrorists directly or, you know, trying to find ways to do things that have impact may not lead to war. Mm-hmm. So as you talk about the Cold War during this time, because if you get a war, it's not going to go very well for anyone. And the idea of, you talked about the British Empire kind of collapsing. People don't realize it perhaps, unless they've been, you know, very astute students of history. But I think the British Empire shrank by what, 300-400%? Yeah, I mean, most of Africa, a lot of East Asia, a lot of these all becoming independent all at once, and kind of filling in that gap between just letting them all go off and do their own thing and hoping that the Soviets don't pop in and take power is something that you can't necessarily do with the armed forces and diplomacy.
Yeah, and as soon as you end up using armed forces or diplomacy, anything open, then there are accusations of imperialism and neo-imperialism. And as more and more states became independent, joined the United Nations, that accusation of neo-imperialism became larger from the UN because there were more recently decolonized states in it. And the Brits were very sensitive to that. They knew, they almost kind of lamented the old days where they could go in with gunboat diplomacy.
Right.
And they suddenly realised, well, we can't do that anymore. We can't go and just kind of wave some guns. We can't go and just fiddle their constitution. So we'll have to be a bit more creative. We'll have to think, okay, well, can we manipulate an election? Can we bribe a particular party? Can we blackmail a particular party? And the other driver, as you alluded to, was the fear of who's going to replace British influence. This was preventative covert action, maybe fearing Soviet exploitation of a power vacuum. So Britain was thinking, well, who are the kind of least worst actor that we, from our perspective, the least worst actor that we can ensure wins this election? And there was a massive, massive process of trying to fiddle those semi-overtly and covertly. But at the same time, there was debate in London about whether this was inherently wrong, whether Britain should not use covert action against colonial populations because it undermined what we thought was our very orderly approach to decolonization. And this is a broader issue of a British covert action. And maybe another driver of British covert action was this tension between the British leaders' self-identity of being gentlemen in a world of players. That it's just, as we say at home, it's just not cricket. Brits don't do that kind of thing. And that was a constant tension between, well, do we do dirty tricks, hidden hand stuff, or do we keep our hands clean and be good Brits about it? And that was, I assume it's still something that's debated today.
Well, to me, what you bring up is an interesting dichotomy that I noticed in the book is the idea that you talk about World War II is really where the professionalization of covert action comes from. You know, people may not know, you know, the SOE and even the SAS and the kind of the professionalization of propaganda operations, information operations. But that was during a war against the Nazis. And there is that foundation that's built during the war, but it seems that successive prime ministers and governments have gone in very different directions from that and maybe left that professionalism behind.
So yeah, I would agree that they have it was professionalized and massively institutionalized during the war, and this left a huge dilemma when the war ended. Do we carry on doing covert action in peacetime? And the Foreign Office, the diplomats in the Foreign Office, were very, very nervous about this. The military were like, hell yeah, let's go for it. The Foreign Office were more cautious. It was risky. It wasn't very British. And it wasn't until the Cold War really heated up that they started to move in that direction. But even then, they were more cautious in the military. There was constant bureaucratic fighting between the two of them, with the diplomats kind of outplaying the military in various political games. But I would argue that prime ministers have actually been pretty similar in their approach to using not just covert action, but intelligence more broadly. They kind of realize the power, and they're often quite seduced by it. They see it as a silver bullet to quietly resolve an intractable problem. And so even as wildly different characters as Clement Attlee, Churchill, Eden, we see a lot of consistency during the post-war era. We might expect, for example, Churchill, when he comes back in 51, we might expect him to recreate Special Operations Executive and hardcore Special Ops because he was so in love with that during the war. But in reality, he was quite cautious. In Europe, anyway. In the Middle East, it's a different story. And he was happy to go nuts. But in Europe, he was quite cautious and carried on Attlee's covert action almost exactly. And the reason was because he wanted to be known as the man who won the Second World War and ended the Cold War. And he was desperate for a Nobel Peace Prize. And so he feared that a special operation going wrong might escalate and undermine that legacy. And you can imagine his reaction when the Nobel Committee one day phones him up and he's so excited. He's like, yes, this is it. I'm going to get my Nobel Peace Prize. And he wins for the Nobel Prize for Literature. And his heart must have sank.
That's fantastic. Another interesting difference between the British version of covert action and the American version is U.S. laws are much more codified when it comes to covert action. I mean, even more today, right? You know, during that time period, it wasn't as much, but now we've got Executive Order 12333 and presidential findings and everything that's more laid down in law. And what I thought was really interesting was the idea that there's no strong line of demarcation in the UK between intelligence collection and covert action. They're so intricately intertwined that you don't necessarily see that as much here. You do now, right? You know, during the war on terror, traditional intelligence and covert action go hand in hand. But during the Cold War, they were kind of different animals in the United States. But that had never really been the case in the UK.
It was partly because we couldn't afford to duplicate resources. In a way, maybe the Americans with greater assets and funding were able to have two separate channels. But they tried. They thought coming out of World War II, they did think, well, these are two separate things. We're going to have intelligence collection first, and that will then inform covert action, just like intelligence would inform any other means of policy execution. But it soon crumbled, and it crumbled as early as 48, 49 in Albania, when they realized that this kind of neat two-step approach, intel, then covert action, wouldn't really work because they had to launch covert actions in Albania in order to gather intelligence to see whether the population was ripe for insurrection. And the chief of SIS came back to the Foreign Office and said, look, I can't send out my officers, my agents, to ask people if they're ready for a revolution. We have to use small-scale covert action as a means of intelligence gathering in its own right. And it gets into quite a detailed conceptual debate which they were having at the time, and it occasionally popped its head back up in the 1960s. They were quite keen to separate intelligence assessments from covert action discussions for fear of polluting the objectivity of the intelligence assessment. But it is generally more fluid. It's more about intelligence. They see covert action as intelligence doing stuff, changing stuff, having an effect. And Britain does have a lot less written down, prefers to operate in this grey zone. It gives them flexibility, it gives them nimbleness, which they believe is an asset for when working with international partners, particularly America. And it wasn't until 1994 in the Intelligence Services Act that MI6 is even legally avowed. So until then, we didn't go through anything like the Church Committee and the various other inquiries. And I think that was another reason why we didn't have much oversight. We didn't have any legal authorization framework, no equivalent to the presidential finding, which have a very different history compared to the CIA. And in fact, the British were petrified during the season of inquiry in the 70s. The Congress was going through various CIA files which involved liaison with the Brits, and the Brits were so scared that our dirty laundry would be aired in Congress, and you can see various files going, oh my goodness, how do we deal with this if it is, because Britain then as now was still very, very secretive.
Well, there's also an interesting difference in that the CIA comes out of OSS, obviously, but there is that gap in between. There is kind of that year and a half when OSS is stood down and you've got CIG and a bunch of other crap in the middle. And then, although you bring in some old OSS guys like Alan Dulles that run the CIA in the 50s, there is that lack of continuity. The person you're talking about in the Balkans, who talked about covert action for the sake of intelligence collection, Stuart Menges, is the same guy who ran SIS for the entirety of World War II. You know, that's this long-running thing. And so I'm wondering, do you see more continuity in action in philosophy? Because you mentioned the fact that Menges noticed in Albania that you needed to do that, but it almost seemed like that was his philosophy going in.
It's a good question. That's not something I've really thought about. There is continuity, yeah. Yeah, there is. So Menges wanted to retire at the end of World War II because they'd won. His kudos was really high. Churchill introduced him. They already met, but paraded him around Buckingham Palace with the King, going, "This man helped us win the war." And Menges thinks, "Well, there's nowhere else for me to go." But he's convinced to stay on for that continuity, for that transition as the Cold War becomes more apparent. And there's continuity in special operations because Britain used the same few people, ex-SOE. So SOE gets closed down in 1946. The capability gets integrated into SIS. Foreign Office gets a veto over covert action. I'm very happy about this. The military less so. But they rely on these same few people who served behind enemy lines in World War II to do British covert action for years afterwards. So it's a very small little group. People like David Smiley, Sterling, McLean, Amory. I mean, there's
it's
a
hard to forget Smiley's name, right? If you think about British intelligence. Sorry.
Yeah, I still manage.
Yeah.
it's a small cluster of people, and they are involved. Maybe not in active terms, but they're planning it. They're meeting with dissidents from World War II And in Amory's case, all the way to the 1990s, it's the same people who just pop up time and time again. Their influence ebbs and flows, as it would in any government, but they're always there. And I think it's this kind of British old boy network from the war who maintained influence for literally decades afterwards. And that did give a sense of continuity and probably helped shape what might be seen as a British way in covert action.
Well, that's why Albania seemed to make so much sense. It was kind of the back door of the SOE. And they knew of the land. They worked there directly on the ground. So it made a ton of sense that it was kind of their test case.
Yeah, and it was literally the same people who had just gone in fighting with the partisans in the war, same people making contact with the same wartime contacts, cashing in those relationships to try and ultimate. Well, this is where the British files are really frustrating, because the actual end goal of Albania, it changed on a daily basis. And you have people like Amory who love covert action, their romance of it all, and love fighting alongside partisans. And they're going to Albania and kind of promising more than was actually agreed in Whitehall. So he's going and saying, let's rise up, let's overthrow Enver Hoxha, the leader, let's liberate the Albanian people. But if you look at the files back home, the foreign secretary's only ever actually agreed to starting a small intelligence gathering operation to see if it's feasible and to disrupt supply lines that are feeding the Greek civil war. So you get this constant disconnect between what certain proponents are saying has been agreed, but what has actually been agreed. And that makes it quite hard for the historian, obviously.
Right.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
Well, how hard? I mean, it's been knee-jerk in the past to blame the failures in the beginning of the Cold War on a simple answer, and that's Kim Philby.
Yeah.
That seems overly simplistic. I think that's a lazy way of looking at this in many cases.
Yeah, I think so. I think Albania is an example of that. The earlier literature gave that exact line. Albania went horribly wrong because that man Philby. Whereas more recent books and files show that the Soviets were aware of it, the Albanians were aware of it before Philby could have known about it, and it shows the some of the dissidents with whom the British worked were rather loose-lipped, to put it lightly, and very factional, and they were fighting each other a lot. And this drove the Foreign Office mad. It drove MI6 mad. And in fact, before they even did this, the Foreign Office, someone in the Foreign Office said, mark my words, working with dissident emigre groups will be a disaster. And as it turned out to be, there was a big I told you so moment in about 1950.
Let me ask you about the pinprick approach. This seems to be almost a compromise between the Foreign Office and the military, between SIS and the Foreign Office, the idea of actually doing things that may have had an effect. Because you did talk about the fact that Stalin became more paranoid, there were purges in Eastern Europe, there were certain things that you can point to as being potential impacts of this. But it doesn't necessarily risk escalation, so it's kind of small and around the edges.
It's really intangible, so it's dead hard to quantify what difference it made. But it involved gradually trying to erode authority, gradually just making a nuisance of yourself. Not through liberation, not through arming people, not through trying to do coups, but through propaganda, planting evidence on officials to discredit them, through even weird stuff. Well, one example which Ming has put forward was stink bombs. Let's use stink bombs behind the Iron Curtain, and it got laughed at because it's a bit silly. But the idea was it would disrupt Communist Party meetings, and it would just add an air of chaos and lack of authority. And that was the approach from 1950, when Attlee signed off on it, literally all the way through until the 70s. This is for Europe. Again, we went a bit more hardcore in further away places where the risk of escalation was perceived to be less. But in Europe, it was gradually eroding, gradually chipping away, causing trouble for the Soviets in their backyard to prevent them from intervening in our neck of the woods. So it was this kind of gradual, constant chipping away.
Well, I mean, big picture, diplomatic historians have been pointing out for a long time that the idea of the Red Army using the whole full Warsaw Pact forces was a complete illusion, that because of the covert action like this, and because of covert action and other efforts being done by other countries like the Americans, the likelihood that the Soviets would have to be worried about the Polish army or the Hungarian army or the Czech army as much as the British or the French or NATO was incredibly high. It's because of these operations to make these satellite states either incredibly suspicious of the Soviets or vice versa, to where the Soviets would probably need to leave some kind of garrison force in the area to guarantee that they don't lose the country altogether while they're fighting NATO.
And in the British files, they're explicit about that. They say, let's make the satellite countries, armed forces, a liability. Let's turn it on its head. They are not a Soviet asset. Let's turn them into a liability. Let's think of all of the fissures between satellite populations and Moscow. Where do they disagree? What are the tensions between them? And let's smash those open. Let's throw in propaganda. Let's create narratives that the Soviets are exploiting Polish economy, or there was a big thing about Czechoslovakian economy, and the Soviets were playing on this. I can't remember the exact example, but the Czechoslovakians were fearing that they were being exploited economically by the Soviets, by the Russians, and so Britain's like, okay, let's make them think that even more.
I mean, then that's classic information operations. Anyone in the United States should understand how that works.
That's one of the things that struck me, was that this is timeless. So regardless of the new internet means of communication, the actual fundamental desire to split people, to split alliances, to create suspicion, to create distrust, is timeless.
You alluded to the fact that Europe, they were a little bit more cautious than they were in other parts of the world, and it seems the Middle East was a major testing ground for British covert action, specifically propaganda, but also other covert action. Even starting as soon as the late 1940s and the move in the repatriation or immigration or whatever word you want to use to Israel, where people may be surprised to know the position that the British government took on immigration to that area of the world.
This was Operation Embarrass, and the goal was to prevent illegal immigration to Palestine from Europe, particularly from the refugee camps in Italy. And operations involved sabotaging ships, which were due, I should add, did not have refugees on them at the time when they blew these ships up, but which were due to carry refugees across the Mediterranean. It involved propaganda to convince them that Palestine would be horrible and they might as well stay in refugee camps in Italy. And yeah, when you think about the context of that and what these people had just gone through and the determination of the Brits going all the way up to the Prime Minister to prevent the excess, as they saw it, immigration, it's quite a striking operation, I think. And then it goes from there. Iran, 53.
Right, I mean, you talk about pinprick before. This was bold. This was not a pinprick operation.
But it still started quite small. And I think that's another kind of aspect of the British approach, is they don't kind of always go hell for leather instantly. Iran took 2 years of undermining Mossadegh until we actually managed to overthrow him with American assistance. And Britain was quite open about how it was trying to manipulate the CIA into bringing them on board. Openly saying, well, let's exaggerate the communist threat, basically. But there's this narrative that, in the British literature anyway, that the Americans, the CIA, were the gung-ho covert actioneers, if that's a phrase. And the Brits were there, the responsible moderates, trying to rein them in to make sure they didn't go and start World War III, which was kind of how we saw ourselves in Europe. But it was completely the other way around in the Middle East. And there's great American files going, Jesus, what the hell are you doing? As Brits are trying to overthrow about four different governments all at the same time in the mid-1950s.
Well, I mean, Nasser in 56 is really kind of the epitome of this, where the Americans actually almost not. There was never a chance of armed conflict between the Americans and the British, but they're at loggerheads. I mean, they're the one weird bedfellow where the Americans and the Soviets are kind of on the same side against the Israelis, French, and British. Like, what the hell is going on here?
But you know what I think is the craziest thing about that whole debacle is that, yeah, the Americans are megally angry at what the Brits did. And yet, we were colluding with the Americans to overthrow the Syrian government like less than a year afterwards and almost doing the same thing. So the plan was, this was autumn 1957, and the plan was to collude with either Iraq or Jordan to intervene in Syria, which would give a pretext for some sort of uprising, revolution to overthrow the Syrian state. Now, that is similar-ish to British colluding with Israel to invade Egypt as a pretext, blah, blah, blah. And I find that kind of different levels of relations and diplomacy really interesting. So you've got the Americans and the British shouting at each other over Suez, but almost simultaneously they are colluding together and with other Middle Eastern allies to do similar stuff in Syria. So there were around the mid-1950s, there were at least three attempts to overthrow the Syrian government, all of which Britain spearheaded and, again, tried to bring the CIA in. Britain was trying to drive a wedge between different factions of the Saudi royal family. There were some great plans to try and kidnap a Saudi sheikh in 1953 as part of a dispute. We were sponsoring tribal raids against the Yemeni imam, propaganda in Oman, Lebanon. It was everywhere, and this was partly a kind of testing ground to see what would work. Partly because Iran had been deemed super successful, and the Foreign Office admitted that they agreed to subsequent operations that they had previously said no to, because Iran had been so successful. And also because Britain, I do think, felt they could operate with a bit more impunity in the Middle East. A lot of these people were imperialists at heart, old-fashioned imperialists who thought that they knew the Arab mind. I mean, Orientalist scholars would have a field day in the British files on here. It's like, we know the Arab mind. We've been here for 200 years.
Right, descendants of T. E. Lawrence. And
all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So we know the propaganda lines to play, because we know how to play these people. Obviously, they didn't.
Well, I mean, there were still limits to how far they would go. I mean, you thought about assassination plots toward NASA that were never carried out, never agreed upon, because, you know, whether it's a new SIS director comes in, Dick White, or other people who are refusing to go that far. I mean, kind of another juxtaposition to the Americans, where assassination wasn't necessarily seen as problematic.
It's hard, yeah, it's hard to know, like, how far these things went, because of, when we talk about earlier about files and sources, this is the stuff that is, it is just not there. And the cabinet secretary, Norman Brook, after Suez, took a load of boxes out of the cabinet office and basically said, no one's ever going to see these. And sure enough, we haven't. So it's hard to know, but we know that that some of the protagonists said they had authority from the Prime Minister himself. We know there were various schemes which were developed. We don't know how far they were ever actually implemented, or even how far they kind of progressed from, I don't know, a chat between two blokes in a London club over cigars and brandy, and how much it was actually a formal operation. But for the famous examples of poison chocolates, exploding cigars, poison gas in NASA's ventilation system. But then you're right, Dick White comes in and he says, however far these have got, stop. We don't do that kind of thing. And he also stopped another request to kill a Thai resistance leader, I think, at the same time. But Dick White, although that was assassination was a step too far, he was still quite in favour of covert action. He wanted to. He still brought his schoolmaster way of thinking to it. He wants to order it and regulate it and normalize it into foreign policy, and it's kind of just kind of low key constant. That was his approach. So no, Britain has no comparable track record of assassination with other countries. But that's not to say we weren't happy when a certain person whom we might have wanted to die ended up being killed, and we were just frankly. Well, how can we could say we're a bit more cowardly about it, a bit less direct. We would potentially, I keep saying we, I've got to stop saying we. Yeah, the Britons, I had no involvement in any of this. The British use propaganda to discredit somebody so much that they are effectively painting a target on that person's back. And there are a couple of examples in the Middle East of propaganda whipping the mob up into a fervor and ultimately killing someone that the Brits were not disappointed to see die, shall we say.
I want to hit up a couple more broad topics. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit chronologically into the 1970s. Because the dynamic in Northern Ireland is really interesting. This is really tricky. It's kind of this domestic, foreign. How do you apply traditional covert action methods to your own territory? And how does that really kind of gel with your laws inside your country? And that to me was really interesting. The propaganda use was extraordinarily good during the Troubles.
And they had to justify it because what was deemed okay on the other side of the world against the Malaysian people or the Indonesians or against the Soviets, who were, you know, the big existential threat. What was deemed okay against them was obviously a lot more problematic, literally on the streets of the UK. And so my favourite way in which they justified subverting their own people, essentially, was to internationalise the IRA and the nationalists. So they said, well, this falls in Foreign Office propaganda remit because A, they're not British, they're Irish. B, they're sponsored by the Soviets, which brings them into our remit. And my favourite was, well, they're Catholic, they've got links to the Vatican City, which is a foreign state, therefore we can subvert them. So you see all this constant kind of self-justification because they know it's dodgy, but for various reasons they think it's necessary.
And some of the ideas, the propaganda ideas, the, you know, chemicals inside bombs can give you cancer, and women's underwear would friction and they'd blow up. But like, it was pretty impressive, some of the ideas that come out of this. I mean, it's a masterclass. I mean, you look back at World War II and some of the ideas that came out of SIS and OSS for propaganda operations were pretty great. But this is a time when you're like, you know what? Well, is it because that was really the limit to what covert action? You're not going to go in there and do any kind of sabotage operation in Northern Ireland necessarily. not direct like you would in like Oman. Propaganda really is your main weapon at this point.
Yeah, as one tool in the broader counterterrorism or counterinsurgency campaign, it was really, really important. But it was particularly important at a more bureaucratic level because the propagandists in the Foreign Office felt under threat at the time. This was an era of detente. There was moves against Cold War propaganda as a thing. We shouldn't be doing it anymore. And they thought, well, we need to justify our existence here. They're having staff cuts, budget cuts. Here is a conflict that we can get involved in and show the overlords at home that we're good and we can make a difference. And the other thing I'd say is that it was ideas or techniques honed over quite a long time now, and that idea of continuity, these same people were being drafted between different regions, ending up serving in Ireland. So they are quite well practiced. And then the third factor potentially is because it was closer to home, the Brits maybe arguably had a better sense of what the fault lines were, what the tensions, what the paranoia, where the nationalists, where the IRA were most vulnerable. Right. It could be a bit because it's our backyard in a way that, or even though we thought we knew the Arab mind, we didn't.
Yeah, I mean, effective propaganda is all about being able to identify where you can stick the knife and twist it.
I think because it was so close to home, we're slightly advantageous in that sense. Well, I don't want to overstate that because they still were far too indiscriminate in their use, and they only actually had one guy on the army propaganda team anyway, who was from Northern Ireland. So I didn't go too far down that, but yeah, definitely more than some of the imperial countries.
Let me bring up the something we've talked about several times kind of tangentially, but let's be, kind of hit it head on, is the cooperation between British covert action and American covert action. As a cooperation between SIS and CIA is pretty extraordinary. And at first, as you explain, the British had the expertise. You know, they're actually the kind of the teachers in many cases. And there's an interesting line that you throw in there from Frank Wisner talking about, anytime we need to do something, there's a British island somewhere nearby that we can launch it from. So kind of the expanse of the British Empire was key. And you mentioned this. Was there a perception among American intelligence that the British were too cautious, too slow, didn't move fast enough, certainly when it came to Europe?
Not as much as I thought there was going to be. And so obviously the relationship is dead close compared to covert action relationships pretty much any other country. It's very, very close. But what struck me within those parameters was how much competition there was and how much rivalry there was and how quickly that cliched narrative of the Americans have the money, the Brits have the expertise, how quickly that fell apart. And as early as Albania, there were tensions, and there's some great files where the Americans are saying, hang on, I thought you guys were supposed to be good. What the heck are you doing over there? And we're doing the same. We're thinking, Jesus, these gung-ho Americans. And it wasn't like we were the cautious ones and the Americans were more provocative. There was one file that really shocked me was an American file saying, geez, the Brits are being a bit much in Eastern Europe. And that goes against everything that I was expecting. So in Albania, they agreed on, what was the phrase, policy coordination but operational disengagement, which basically means we're going for the same goal, but let's not interfere with each other, because at one point, I think a British-trained team and an American-trained team were kind of chasing each other inadvertently around Albania because it's such a small country. And it kind of went from there. And, we mentioned Iran. We were deliberately trying to recruit, for want of a better word, CIA involvement. Syria in 56, we were putting the pressure on again. And the idea, I think Britain saw covert action as a means of maintaining leverage in what was an increasingly asymmetric relationship. But covert action, or intelligence more broadly, is one of the few areas where Britain can genuinely offer something. I think that and nuclear weapons, right, traditionally. So we were desperately trying to keep the Americans on board. But there was still competition. One of my favorite examples was British Guyana in the 1960s, when Chedi Jagan comes to power and the CIA petrified about a Soviet Marxist inspired regime on their doorstep. And the CIA says to Britain, can we do some covert action here? Can we overthrow Jagan? And Britain's like, well, no, I don't really want to. Let's try another election first. Let's try some more open influence first. And eventually, Harold Macmillan, the Prime Minister, thinks, okay, well, let's let the Americans do it. It's their backyard. It's their sphere of influence. But he delighted in making the Americans squeal first and tell us how great colonialism was and how we couldn't possibly let the British Guyanans become independent because they couldn't be trusted. And this is just wonderful line in Macmillan's diary where he's like, yeah, we're going to let them do it, but don't tell them yet. Let's make them dance first. And the Colonial Office were the same. The Colonial Office, there's this wonderful file. I think it related to British Guyana. But it was like, well, how dare the Americans accuse us of colonialism? Let's count their colonial territories. Wyoming, Hawaii, Alaska. And it goes on like this. Pretty much every state outside of the original few. And it's just this kind of constant little rivalry, which struck me. Because it wasn't as close and integrated as I think the common understandings suggest.
Special relationship wasn't necessarily as special as we might have thought.
No.
You mentioned the fact that Church and Pike kind of freaked out the British a little bit because of potential dirty laundry coming out. That didn't necessarily stop them from being tied at the hip in two prominent 1980s covert actions that most people think are primarily American, and that's Afghanistan and Iran-Contra, where there was a heavy British hand. In fact, in both cases, it's unlikely these operations could have been carried out at all if it wasn't for the cooperation between CIA and SIS.
And the files are starting to come out at home. Obviously, they're very sparse. But what really struck me about Afghanistan is this weird situation where the Brits wanted to be involved, wanted to help, partly to maintain the special relationship, so-called special relationship, partly because it was in our interest to do it as well. But it was a lot of it revolved around facilitation. A lot of it revolved around trying to convince the Pakistanis, the Chinese, various North Africans to get involved. And there was a wonderful, almost paradoxical a line that the British Foreign Secretary Lord Carrington gave when he said, "Oh, we're not doing anything in Afghanistan," which obviously he would say. But then he said, "But maybe we are," just to kind of give the impression that we were doing more than we actually were, which raises all sorts of interesting questions about the nature and purpose of covert action.
Well, it's one of these counterfactuals, but almost these what ifs where the British were very valuable in the beginning because they did have the capability of bringing in weapons and contacts, or maybe you could freeze out the Pakistanis, the ISI. Obviously, the facilitation of arming the Mujahideen depended heavily, when all said and done, on a close-knit relationship between CIA and ISI, which has had its ups and downs over the years. So looking back at this and reading this, I'm like, oh, if only, right? If only the British really had been in a position to facilitate this without bringing in the people who would later facilitate the Taliban and to help bin Laden and everybody else, that could have been a very different world.
And that was the British pitch. Yeah. The pitch was, look, you don't need to go through ISI. We've got contacts in certain areas of Afghanistan, which are longstanding as a direct result of our colonial history, of our long history in Afghanistan. Use them. Let's work together. And it was another example of where the Brits were trying to use contacts, sources, legacy to maintain influence in the American relationship. And Britain was sending training teams to Afghanistan on an annual basis, I think. But gradually, as the decade progressed, I think the British role waned. I think it was facilitative for the first little bit. Then we sent some more direct training teams in. And then from 84, 85 onwards, as far as like we can tell, obviously the files may completely prove me wrong, but it seemed to die down.
So let me wrap up by asking you about transitions, because like the CIA, SIS scrambled when the Cold War ended to find a role. And in many cases, like the CIA, they picked up things like counterproliferation and counter-narcotics and counterterrorism, organized crime. Was there a retrenchment of covert action? I mean, where are we today or in the last 10 years or so compared to where we were at the height of the Cold War when it comes to the role of covert action and the broader British governmental system? So I know in your book you talk about even Iraq in 2003, about Tony Blair advocating for a covert action solution to the Iraq invasion. No one necessarily listening to that, certainly not on this side of the Atlantic. But I'm wondering if you've seen, and again, you don't have access to everything, but from what you know, if you've seen there has been an increase, a decrease, it stayed consistent.
The chief of SIS gave a speech in early December, and it was only his second public speech. It's very, very rare they ever say anything publicly. And he gave a line where he said, one of SIS's key roles today is, a paraphrase, mastering covert action in the digital realm. And he said, when I started as a junior officer, it was all about intelligence gathering. Now it's about shaping. It's obviously not true. We've been doing covert action a very long time, but for a chief to come out and say this is one of the primary functions of SIS is disrupting terrorism and Russian operations, essentially. I found that quite striking to come out and say it so publicly. But there's still, even though the context is very different, there's still a lot of continuity. So he talked about the role of SIS is disrupting terrorist threats at source, overseas. In a previous speech, he talked about disrupting terrorist threats in their half of the pitch, which is almost word for word identical as to how Harold Macmillan described MI6's role in the 1950s, where he said, your role is to, quote, disrupt anti-British activities at source. So there's no change there. The covert action is and has always been important in disrupting and keeping the threat away from the British mainland and making life difficult for adversaries.
So the book is Disrupt and Deny: Spy Special Forces in the Special Secret Pursuit of British Foreign Policy. The author is Rory Cormack. This is a really great mix of well-researched kind of historic intelligence while still being readable, which it's not all that easy to do, right? Every so often, I think, Oxford University Press?
It was.
When you see that, you're like, oh, okay, well, this is going to be one of those books. But it was surprising. I mean, it's about covert action, right? So it's not going to be readable. So it's always nice to find a book that you can go, you know what, this is really well-researched, and I am not falling asleep while reading it. So congratulations
on that. Thank you, Vince.
Rory, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast.
Pleasure. Thank you.